And as Dave and I were discussing before we began the show, it perhaps at least offers one scenario that might explain why the United States we have no luck whatsoever at solving any of our political assassinations, besides coming up with lone nut scapegoats, whereas in the Philippines it very quickly became obvious exactly that if nothing else, that the military had set this up, that they had executed Benigno Aquino, and that the whole rest of the thing with the communist scapegoat, et cetera, was a hoax, and that this all came out in fairly short order. Well, if just to run a scenario out, if Benigno Aquino was the chosen man of certain people in the Philippines as well as the United States to be the successor to Marcos and to be a quote-unquote more moderate successor or a more acceptable successor, it's very possible that whoever decided to have Aquino off was going against the mainstream opinion of the powers that be in parts of the Philippines and the United States, and that therefore they are being dealt with as quickly as possible in the situation for having offended the great and divine plan for the future of the Philippines. It's just a possible scenario.
Scenario which is also reminiscent in some ways of the attempts during the closing years of World War II, which is something we're going to look at during the second part of the program, to form the residual elements of the Third Reich into a Hitler-less and more internationally palatable anti-Soviet coalition.
Of course, as one looks back on Watergate and one discovers people like Maurice Stans, Henry Kissinger, et al. Creeping back into the White House and creeping back into the Reagan administration, all the other folks, all the other Nixon fixtures that came back under Reagan, and of course the covert core of Watergate, which has not been basically has come back stronger than ever, as we've been detailing over the last 4 years or so, 5 years, I guess, since the Reagan regime began, the Reagan Reich. It makes you wonder if you can ever go home again. It makes you wonder if the purge will ever happen. But until it does, we're going to keep pitching out here, and we hope you'll be with us.
Of course, one of the problems is that the Watergate was never really investigated fully, just like the Kennedy assassination and a lot of other investigations. And we're going to suggest part of the problem this evening.
The system works. That's what everybody used to say. The system works, and Watergate proves it. Right, okay, so...
One sense, that could be said to be true.
Yeah, right. The system works, but whose system? That's the question. Well, speaking of systems, and while you think about the fact of George McGovern living on his miserable little ranch out in South Dakota while Richard Nixon flies around the world and advises Ronald Reagan on his presidential decisions and goes to China to be greeted by thousands of screaming Chinese people, while you're reflecting on these and whether or not the system works and whose system, we're going to talk about someone's system and how it worked, starting off with a very recent article, Thursday, September 12th, to be specific, from the San Jose Mercury News. The headline is Hitler's Last Soldier in U.S. Finally Surrenders. It's Dateline Los Angeles. It's an AP Wire story, and it goes as follows. World War II ended Wednesday for Sergeant Georg Gertner of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's Africa Corps, who surrendered in tears 40 years after fleeing a prisoner of war camp in New Mexico. By the way, let me just insert this before we get to the actual part of the article. Remember the way that they start this off, the melodramatic way this article starts about World War II finally ending for Georg Gertner, because as you will see in the article as we read it, Georg... it mentions how really tough it was for Georg the last 40 years as he fled World War II.
Yeah, the cordite isn't exactly caked on his Africa Corps ears here.
Indeed. Okay, going along. Georg Gertner, age 64, who lives near Denver under the name Dennis Wiles, spelled W-H-I-L-E-S, has written a book, quote, Hitler's Last Soldier in America, published Wednesday to coincide with his surrender to the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service. He was the last of 2,000 escaped German prisoners of war to be recaptured in the United States. He has been married to a U.S. citizen for 21 years. Skipping down in the article, he said he escaped, meaning escaped back in 45. He said he escaped because he knew Soviet troops had taken his hometown of Schweidnitz, and he feared he would be placed in a slave labor camp if sent back. He crept under a fence on September 21, 1945, and hopped a westbound freight train that took him to San Pedro. Ezel, who is an INS director, Ezel said the FBI and INS had forgotten about Gertner, whose file was closed in 1976, until his attorneys, Ronald T. Oldenburg of Hawaii and Michael John Biber of Los Angeles, contacted them and arranged the surrender. Skipping on down, Gertner joined the German army in 1940 at age 19 and was in Africa in April 1943 when Rommel's forces were overrun. His division was shipped to the United States, and in September 1945, he escaped from Camp Deming. He worked as a dishwasher, lumberjack, migrant farm worker, and ski instructor in California and adopted the name Dennis Wiles. He married in 1964 and opened a tennis club in Aptos, associating with such celebrities as Bjorn Borg, Lloyd Bridges, and Robert Stack, Biber said. In 1974, Gertner moved to Hawaii, working as an architectural consultant. Ironically, his wife became executive director of the Hawaii Refugee Resettlement Organization, dealing with thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia. Well, we're going to talk about some other things, more specifically dealing with the subject of prison camps, the United States prison camps, and the German soldiers therein interned. But again, one has to note not only the melodrama of his 40 years later that World War II ends for this man while he's an architectural consultant in Hawaii and palling around with Bjorn Borg and Dennis Stack and, Robert Stack and all these folks and running a tennis club in Aptos. It is, of course, also interesting to note that his wife does become executive director of the Hawaii Refugee Resettlement Organization, dealing with, as the paper says, thousands of refugees from Southeast Asia. And, of course, no necessary connection between these things, but it is interesting that a large amount of the refugees from Southeast Asia are people displaced by the American war effort in Vietnam, and quite a few of them were people who felt they had to leave Southeast Asia because of their involvement with the Americans or with the government of Vietnam or the fallen government of Cambodia or Laos or something of that sort. So it's just interesting to note that as we pass.
Also worth noting that this fugitive from justice was running a tennis club in Aptos with such Hollywood celebrities as Robert Stack and Lloyd Bridges and people like Bjorn Borg. Then goes as an architectural consultant to Hawaii. Again, he was not exactly picking his teeth with a bayonet and dodging Spitfires at every turn. I mean, the lead paragraph there makes the whole thing sound just a little more intense than it was.
It's quite a bit different than those guys they talk about that they find out in, Mindanao or Okinawa who've been hiding up in the bushes for 40 years eating rabbits. You know, it's not quite the same thing.
Any bushes he's been hiding behind might have a capital B, and if that sounds like we're stretching a point, the reason why we brought up that perhaps arcane-seeming article to some of you was that the rather lenient treatment that he's received, certainly he's done fairly well for himself for a fugitive from justice, and one of the things that we're asking ourselves here is whether his relatively decent fortunes were due to the fact that the effort to get him was less than enthusiastic. We bring that up because basically, returning once again to the closing years of World War II, which is a period we focus on so often, as we said a few minutes ago, the residual elements of the Third Reich, which were considered either more useful or more palatable than Hitler and some of his closest associates, were incorporated into not only the West German government after World War II, but also into our own intelligence system and defense department, as we looked at in our last Radio Free America broadcast, and in general were forged into just the sort of broad-based anti-Soviet alliance which elements on both sides of the Atlantic were looking to form during the closing years of World War II. Now, by way of building what at the time was considered to be an anti-communist bulwark across Europe, those Germans who were of pro-Hitler and consequently anti-communist sentiment were accorded relatively lenient treatment by the U.S. authorities as well as the British and elements of the French following World War II. Specifically, anti-Hitler POWs in the United States were allowed to, were not only discouraged from normal political expression, but specifically the pro-Hitler elements within the German prisoner of war camps in the United States, in other words, camps for German POWs, they were basically run by pro-Hitler elements. The American authorities allowed the Nazis to run these camps, and during the closing years of World War II, actually, many Germans who expressed pro-Hitler sentiments were murdered and otherwise disciplined.
Anti-Hitler sentiments.
expressed anti-Hitler sentiments. I mean, because the pro-Hitler forces were running these camps at the discretion of the American forces. And in addition, as we're going to see here in just a second, many of the pro-Hitler Germans were allowed conjugal visits from their wives so that their children, being born in the United States, would be American citizens from birth. This, again, to be seen in the context of the importation of the Galen organization and thousands of SS and Gestapo men, as well as the Project Paperclip scientists, both of which we've spoken about on programs in the past, our Radio Free America and Guns of November shows. Now, of the extraordinary treatment accorded German POWs in this country during the closing years of World War II, and again, seeing this against the background of the incorporation of the residual elements of Nazism into a broad-based coalition immediately after World War II, we're going to take a look at a book called The Nazis Go Underground. We've looked at the book before. The book was authored by Kurt Reiss, R-I-E-S-S, and Reiss basically was an anti-fascist and espionage author whose work was eclipsed during the McCarthy period. And of the, The Nazis Go Underground was published in hardcover by Doubleday and Duran and Company and copyrighted 1944, first printing March of 1944. So we're going to sort of climb in the time machine here and go back to 3 months before D-Day, 3 months before the Normandy invasion. Kurt Reiss writes in The Nazis Go Underground, "The United States, in an overgenerous interpretation of the Geneva Convention for Prisoners of War, has allowed these people to run their prison camps as a Nazi state within our country. They may heil Hitler, may refuse to have anything to do with non-Aryans, Jews or American Negroes, may arrange entertainments which mock the institutions and the leading personalities of the democracies, and they may even punish those of their own number who either have been always anti-Nazi or have come to doubt the value of the Hitler religion. This state of affairs would not be so bad if, after the war, these men and women could be deported to Germany. But there is little chance of this outwardly at least. Since, outwardly at least, Germany will then become strictly anti-Nazi, and the men who will be running the German government will have to make a real show of their anti-Nazi conviction by putting all confirmed Nazis into a concentration camp. This gives the prisoners interned here the right to appeal against being sent back to Germany, and the United States, being a humane country, will probably let them stay. But many of these Nazis are not taking any chances. They are thorough. It is a fact, though it has never been published, that many of the internees find ways and means to meet their wives and have intercourse with them. The reason for this procedure, which incidentally is strictly against the law, is that a child may thus be produced, a child which, having been born on American soil, cannot be deprived of its American citizenship. And parents of such an American citizen are very difficult to deport. All of which means that we can be quite certain of having these dangerous enemy aliens, unquote, with us after the war. And that is what the coming Nazi underground is counting on. Now, we're going to take a look at specifically one of the aspects of the disturbing situation described by Kurt Reiss in Nazis Go Underground, namely the manner in which the pro-Hitler elements in POW camps in the United States were allowed to discipline, punish, and at times murder those anti-Hitler elements that were discovered in their midst. In order to take a look at this, we're going to go back to another book published during World War II, during the closing months. This is The Plot Against the Peace, co-authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N, published in hardcover by the Dial Press, copyright March of 1945, so 1 year later than the Nazis Go Underground. March of 44, now we're going to jump in the time machine and go ahead 1 year to about 3 months, 4 months actually, before the war ends in Europe. Describing now the FEMA, which were the secret underground murder gangs of the Freikorps and Black Reichswehr, which dispatched the real or potential enemies of Nazism prior to Hitler's ascent before World War II. Basically, FEMIC units were formed in the German POW camps in the United States and proceeded to weed out anti-Hitler or potential anti-Hitler elements within the prisoner of war camps in the United States, as just indicated in the passage Kurt Reiss talked about. Now, specifically here, we're going to talk about how the Germans were able to weed out the political dissidents in their midst, the Nazis, that is, in American POW camps. Sayers and Kahn write in The Plot Against the Peace, in a section called The FEMA in America. In January of 1945, the United States War Department made public some of the facts concerning the reign of terror which German army officers and Gestapo agents had instituted in German war prison camps in America. In 1943, within a few months after the thousands of German prisoners taken by the American Army in North Africa began streaming into the United States, The official War Department report disclosed that small groups of fanatical officers began to impose themselves as dominating factors on the German prison camp committees. In many camps, these men elected their own choices as camp spokesmen, unquote. Figureheads were chosen while the ringleaders remained in the background in order to conceal their identity from the American authorities. Propaganda was circulated that it was the duty of the prisoners to remain pure Germans, unquote, and to return to Germany after the war to carry out the work of the Nazi cause. All those suspected of anti-Nazism or distaste for German militarism were subject to intimidation and terror. Beatings of anti-Nazi prisoners were frequent. A series of violent deaths finally exposed the systematic character of this terrorism. The New York Times reported on January 16, 1945, that, quote, six murders and two forced suicides have occurred in German prisoner of war camps in the United States, and investigations by the War Department have indicated that in all but one of those eight cases, the victims were anti-Nazis who had been accused of treason by fellow prisoners. Some were charged with giving information to the American authorities, others with speaking or writing anti-Nazi views. Now, still later, Sayers and Kahn to go on to describe a specific murder of a German prisoner of war in the United States. At Camp Tonkawa, T-O-N-K-A-W-A, Oklahoma, on November 4, 1943, the FEMA unit murdered Corporal Johann S. Kunz, K-U-N-Z-E, of Leipzig. Kunz was beaten to death. After the murder, a meeting was called in the mess hall. A German officer said that Kunz had been accused of high treason, unquote, in transmitting information to the American camp authorities. The German officer stated that the killing had been done in self-defense, unquote, and that it would be reported later to a German military court. Well, now note that Corporal Kunz was murdered because the Germans accused him of high treason by communicating information to American authorities. We're going to touch on the Kunz case here. We're obviously not going to have the time to go over all of it or even most of it. In a nutshell, Corporal Kunz was murdered by fellow inmates who accused him of communicating damaging information to the American authorities. Now, in the investigation of the Kunz case, it came across that the pro-Hitler officers, the pro-Hitler inmates in these POW camps, had learned about Kunz. Kunz basically was less than thrilled with Hitler. He was drafted into the German army at the age of 38, and in letters to his wife, expressed some things about the sad state of Hamburg during the war and the effects of Allied bombings on Hamburg, and also expressed, which he had been through apparently at some point with his unit, also expressed a desire perhaps to settle in the United States with his wife after the war, because specifically they wanted to get away from Germany and Nazism. So Kunz, because of the anti-Nazi views that were in some of the letters to his wife, was murdered by his fellow inmates. The subsequent investigation into the murder of Corporal Kunz centered on these letters and how the German inmates were able to get access to the letters and thus learn of Kunz's anti-Nazi sentiments. Of course, they accused him of communicating this information directly to the American authorities. And again, the information was gleaned from letters from Kunz to his wife, and the whole investigation about the killing of Corporal Kunz centered on where he got those letters. Now, ultimately, five Germans who had been prisoners of war at the Tonkawa camp were executed for the murder of Corporal Kunz. Nobody else, just five former POWs. So remember the ultimate disposition of the case and the key piece of evidence being how the letters came into possession of the pro-Hitler inmates of the Tonkawa camp.
Okay, and this book we're going to be reading a short bit from is called The Killing of Corporal Kunz. Again, as Dave said, spelled K-U-N-Z-E.
And research credit for this connection here, this book, goes to Mae Russell, who turned us on to it.
Right. And the book is written by Wilma Parnell, P-A-R-N-E-L-L, with Robert Tabor. And it is published by Lyle Stewart, Incorporated, copyright 1981.
And Wilma Parnell, by the way, was the court reporter, the court stenographer, in the investigation of the murder of Corporal Kunz.
Okay. Now, they're talking about a man by the name of Rehberger being interrogated at this moment. Now, there's again, as Dave mentioned, that one of the subjects at hand is the most important subject is how did the Germans, who eventually wound up having Kunz killed, find out about these communications between himself and his wife? Okay, we'll explain some of these other things as we go along, too. So, again, reading from the Killing of Corporal Kunz. It required a good deal more time, patience, and tears. But in the end, the unhappy prisoner, or medical soldier, as he preferred reluctantly admitted that, yes, Heisig, H-E-I-S-I-G, had told him about the notes and had said that they were obtained from Lieutenant Young. Okay, the notes they're referring to are the notes that that were used to implicate Kunz as far as the other Germans were concerned and led to his death. And this man, Rehberger, says that Heisig, who, as we will find out, is another German, had told him that the notes were obtained from a Lieutenant Young, Y-O-U-N-G, who is an American. It was discovered that Lieutenant Young was on leave. He would be back in a couple of days. Maffett, who's one of the investigators, sent for Feldwebel Karl Heisig. Heisig had penetrating dark eyes in an arresting manner that hinted at qualities beyond those of the ordinary Feldwebel. It was rumored at the time that the prisoner of war camps for enlisted men held a sprinkling of high-ranking Wehrmacht officers disguised as non-coms. And it crossed my mind, this is the author Wilma Parnell talking, and it crossed my mind that Heisig might well be one of them. Certainly he behaved as though he felt in complete command of his own interrogation. He admitted that he had given the, quote, spy notes to Hauptfeldwebel Beyer, B-E-Y-E-R, who's one of the guys eventually convicted. But he refused to say how or where he had obtained them. When Major Fuller appealed for his cooperation in the interest of a fair investigation, Heisig responded with equanimity, quote, sir, you can kill me. I will not say one word. I can understand how the boys felt. It's a crime to write things like that about one's country. Skipping down. You know where you got the note, but won't tell us? They're asking Heisig. Yes, sir. Would your telling implicate someone else? Yes, sir. Then in that case, someone innocent may suffer. Isn't that so? I can't help it. I would rather suffer myself. Heisig, are you a member of the Nazi Party? Yes, sir. The questioning dragged on. Heisig yielded nothing. Did you get this note from an American? I cannot answer. I found it. Where? Anywhere. Now look here, Heisig, if you got it from an American, you aren't betraying your homeland by telling us so. I am an honest man. I never betray anyone. Heisig was dismissed. He saluted smartly, his expression inscrutable, but I thought there was a flicker of amusement in his brown eyes as he turned to leave. He marched sedately from the hearing room with more assurance than any of us felt at that moment. Skipping on down. Heisig was brought back after lunch for another sparring match. Nothing had changed. He refused point-blank to identify the American lieutenant or anyone else as the source of the notes. Asked whether it would not have been natural for Rehberger to have inquired where Heisig had obtained the notes, Heisig calmly replied, "Yes, sir. Beyer asked me to, but I didn't tell." "Didn't you have enough confidence in Rehberger to tell him the whole story?" "I don't trust anyone, not even myself." "Are you keeping quiet to protect American or German personnel?" "I cannot answer. I am honest. Someday I want my family to know that I died an honorable man who loved his country." The officers called it a day. Immediately upon his return to camp, Lieutenant Young testified. He had none of Heisig's assurance. Responding slowly under the prompting of Major Fuller, he told the panel that the prisoner, Karl Heisig, inspected all mail sent out of the hospital by German patients and workers, and saw to it that letters were properly addressed, correctly folded, and packaged for the postal authorities. Heisig also functioned apparently as an unofficial censor, making sure that the letters contained no prohibited information. The adjutant said Heisig had the freedom of the entire hospital, confidential files accepted, and frequently went from one office to another in the performance of his duties. Young said that he was often away from his own office. Mail and other documents were sometimes placed on his desk by error, he said, and on such occasions it became his responsibility to feed them back into the proper channels. Skipping down, Major Fuller seized the first opportunity to interrupt him, waving away more elaborate explanations. Quote, "Lieutenant Young," he said, "I hand you this paper marked Exhibit A, the notes, and ask you to look at it carefully, read it, and state for the record whether or not you gave this document to Feldwebel Karl Heisig." Young, perspiring and flushed pink to the roots of his steel-gray hair, stared at the paper for a while and said flatly, "I have no knowledge of ever seeing this before." While not strictly responsive, the statement was clear enough. It was the last we were to hear from or of the lieutenant. He was whisked away to another assignment, and his name was never mentioned again in my presence. Astonishingly, Heisig, too, vanished at this juncture. He was transferred to another jurisdiction before he could be questioned again, and the trail of the document that had triggered the mess hall killing stopped with him. It had appeared one day in his hands, and he had handed it to Beyer. That was all we ever surely knew. Okay, before we go on, let me just point this out again, exactly what's going on here. Apparently, at some point, the document crossed Lieutenant Young, the American's, desk, and went into the hands of Carl Heisig, this medical soldier, as he calls himself, who was a German prisoner, essentially, and had a great deal of freedom within the operation of the prison camp to censor other prisoners' mail, to inspect their mail, and often having access to things in other people's offices. So at some point, not only was this particular bit of documentation important for the prosecution of a murder on American soil, but in fact it also was suggestive of an entire way of dealing with things in these prison camps that could have used some looking into. But in fact, as the author points out, not only the American lieutenant but the German were both whisked out of the jurisdiction of the investigation and were never questioned anymore on the matter.
Now, right after this point in the testimony, which, again, a obviously pro-Hitler German, a member of the Nazi Party, was allowed to censor all of the other inmates' mail as a result of the information which he admittedly communicated to the other Germans, a man was murdered, the American officer who allowed this kind of behavior is in no way involved in the investigation, and the trail stops. Eventually, five Germans were executed for the five German POWs for the murder of Kunz. But at this point, the prosecution basically was expanded. A person was brought in to oversee the course of the prosecution from this point, and this particular individual did not pursue either Officer Young or Heisig or the main connection in the case, which was why the Germans, the pro-Nazi Germans, were allowed basically to run these camps like they were their own little fiefdoms. And this special prosecutor is a person whose name we've come across in the past.
And interestingly enough, this involvement of this person we're going to be talking about was roughly coincident with the decision on the part of somebody in the United States Armed Forces to suddenly put the lid on this trial and make it secret. In other words, to ban the press and ban any kind of spectators or things of that nature. So, well, it was basically a fairly simple matter of a murder in a prison camp became apparently enough of an embarrassment or a worry at some levels that it was made a secret trial. Anyway, reading again from the Parnell and Tabor book. At this point, Lieutenant Colonel Leon Jaworski of the Judge Advocate General's office in Dallas entered the case. I saw at once that I was nowhere near the finish line. For the moment, frustration engulfed me. I was sick of Blut und Geschlagen. Jaworski's quiet confidence was a quick restorative. All I knew of him at the time came from Fuller's description, quote, a crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas before he came to the Army, unquote. Skipping along. Although an interpreter was present at all times, the, quote, crackin' good trial lawyer from Texas, unquote, dealt with the witnesses directly, speaking a fluent German, which he later told me he had picked up as a child. Skipping on. The judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, this is at the end of the trial, the judge advocate remarks on a prosecution, quote, brilliantly and masterfully conducted by Jaworski and Fuller, and also praises the prosecutors for their commendable restraint and for having been, quote, faithful to their responsibilities to produce all of the evidence irrespective of its effect, unquote. Well, as we saw, they certainly didn't produce much more evidence on Young and Heisig, since both of them were allowed to leave before the interrogations were finished and then moved out of the jurisdiction. Skipping on down. In his closing remarks, Jaworski says he has never before appeared in a court anywhere in which so much consideration was given to the facts of the case. Again, one has to wonder about that, if that's a slightly ironic statement, or if that's really true, what kind of cases was Jaworski involved in before? Quote, I am happy over it, he adds, because when this court writes its findings in this matter, it will come as the result of painstaking consideration of the evidence that has been presented, so that everyone knows, no matter who he is, no matter where he may be, that these accused have gotten the fair, impartial trial they are entitled to under the laws of this land. Well, interesting. And the commendable restraint that Leon Jaworski showed here, as we have talked about earlier in the show, crop up later on when, among other things, he's involved in Watergate, which, as Dave and I both suggested in our own personal opinions, perhaps was not prosecuted with quite the commendable lack of restraint that might have been necessary to have done something besides pardon Richard Nixon and cover the rest of the thing up.
In between his commendable restraint in prosecuting the Coons trial and Watergate, Jaworski went from the Coons trial, incidentally, to Nuremberg, and those who have listened to these shows for some time know about the commendable restraint that the Nuremberg prosecutors also used, since many of the defendants in those trials wound up working for our national security establishment. And after that, well, he then went to work for, among other things, an organization called the M.D. Anderson Fund, of which he was a member of the board of directors, which was a CIA domestic funding conduit. He then served as special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, investigating the JFK assassination for the state of Texas, also did the same thing for the Warren Commission, and specifically was in charge with seeing whether Lee Harvey Oswald had any intelligence connections. Connections between, of course, the JFK assassination and Watergate, we talked about in Radio Air Raid Guns of November number 3. And following Watergate special prosecutor, he then jumps ahead and becomes special prosecutor for the Koreagate scandal, in which the Unification Church and its role as a front for the Korean CIA and its role in that behalf in the United States were front and center. Now, jumping back once again to the Watergate hearings, did you want to say something? Oh, I thought I saw a hand signal there. Research credit for this final item here, talking about special prosecutor Leon Jaworski's commendable restraint. Reading now from book 11 of the hearings before the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, that is the Watergate and Related Activities hearing. This is popularly known as the Watergate Committee. Reading now from phase two of their hearings, from the hearings that were held on October 4th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 31st of 1973. This is from Book 11, and again, the research credit here goes to Mae Brussel. And from the Watergate transcripts, we find an interesting exchange here between Senator Talmadge of the Senate Watergate Committee and a Mr. Benz, B-E-N-Z, who was an employee of the so-called Dirty Tricks Unit of the Nixon White House employed by Donald Segretti. Talmadge says here, "I believe you two had subordinates. One was named Mr. Duke, and the other was named Mr. Hearing. Is that right? Mr. Benz. His nickname was Duke. I do not believe that was his last name. Talmadge. One was named Duke and the other Hearing? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did Mr. Hearing tell you that this man Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Did you believe that? Benz. No, sir. Talmadge. Did Duke ever tell you that? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. Talmadge. Did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned him to? Benz. I do not know of any training school that would train him for this work. Talmadge. I could not hear you. Mr. Benz. I said I do not know of any training school that would train a person for this type of work. Talmadge. Were not the activities quite similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida? Benz. I would not know that, Senator. Talmadge. You have read some history of that period, have you not? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Have you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I take it? Benz. Correct. Talmadge. Are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers somewhat similar? Benz. I do not recall if he ever did or not. That, of course, in the context that he replied. Talmadge. I thought they were. I read about a good many falsified documents during that era and libels and slander about the opposition. It was one of the ways, as I recall, that Adolf Hitler achieved power. Do you think Duke carried on his activities in an exemplary fashion in that manner, do you? Benz. Yes, sir. Talmadge. No further questions, Mr. Chairman. So again, that's from part of the Watergate hearings that you didn't hear publicly, that didn't look quite so neat on television. And of course, Watergate special prosecutor Leon Jaworski of the CIA showed a commendable restraint, as some might phrase it, in not taking up this as well as the many other aspects of the Watergate question that we've come across in the past. Recall that Nixon's Nazi connections were the subject of considerable discussion in Radio Free America show number 2.
Okay, now I have a question for you, Dave, which is, do you think we do have something here you wanted to roll while we get phone calls, or are you saving that till the end?
Let's take phone calls as soon as we can. We can play that and then play some of it at the end. It doesn't matter.
Okay.